Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. There is now a date for Prince George's County students and teachers to go back to the classroom in some form. On Wednesday, school CEO Dr. Monica Golson making that announcement. And tonight, we're going to talk to her and we're going to hear from our listeners about this complex back-to-school process. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or you can find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Golson, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Mr. Fisher.
Absolutely. So let's get right into it. As I said, this is an extremely complex plan. There are a lot of moving parts that are already underway. Can you give me the Cliff Notes version of it? Where are we right now, and how does it work leading up to April 8th?
Yes, thank you so much for this opportunity. So
Sure. We're
at a point now where families are making a decision between now and Sunday, February 28th, on whether they would like to have their child return to school on April 8th or April 15th in a hybrid model, or if they want them to continue in a virtual learning experience. And to start in hybrid means that based on their last name, they will either attend school on Monday, Tuesday for in-person instruction, or Thursday, Friday, from April until the last day of school, which is on June 16th.
So how did you come to this process? Because there is a lot to this, even after all of the surveys come in and are finished on the 28th. So kind of give me the genesis of where this all started. Obviously, this is not a plan that you developed overnight. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, definitely not. Believe it or not, it's been a long time coming since March 16th of 2020, because that is the first day that we missed in-person instruction and have been since the pandemic started. But what has transpired over the time that we've been in this pandemic and in the virtual learning experience is that I had the opportunity to have an external medical advisory team that I meet with every 2 weeks, and they are leaders in the pediatric field who are frontline workers who know exactly what's going on in terms of the COVID-19 virus, vaccinations, how it's impacting students, and how it's impacting our community. And so I'm grateful, like, they are doctors who live in Prince George. One lives in Prince George's County, one lives in another part of Maryland, one works in D.C. Children's Hospital. So they were very helpful in helping to arrive at the decision. Mm-hmm. In addition, we have posted since October the COVID-19 numbers for our entire county, and we do it daily. And so our community, as well as our staff, and even our students, could easily go on and see how many positive cases we've had each day, whether they were increasing or decreasing, and what that looked like for in-person learning. And then in January, the beginning of the rollout of the vaccination became part of our conversations with our external medical advisory team and just internally around what we would feel comfortable moving forward in terms of opening school. And so all three of those areas played an integral part of my decision-making around the right time to reopen.
Governor Hogan and the head of the state board, the state of state education, Dr. Karen Salmon, has said for weeks, if not months, that they wanted everyone to go back by March 1st, but you have everyone going back a month later than that. Talk to me about that decision-making process. Why April? Why not the first week of March?
Yeah, so we have made sound decisions from the time that we had to return to our homes and do virtual learning until now. And it really is sound decisions based on metrics. And so I respect that the governor and the state superintendent had to make a decision that impacted the entire state of Maryland. But for the community that I live in and serve in, we were the hardest hit in the state of Maryland in terms of COVID-19 cases. And for us, as I began to look at data and monitor data, while we've seen a decrease in COVID-19 cases since January 22nd, having a mathematics background, I knew that we were not going to get to a safe zone by March 1. And so I had to have conversations with our own county executive and all of our board members to say, I want our kids and staff back in just as much as anyone else, but I can't do it unless I feel comfortable and know that it's safe for everyone to do so. And as we begin to extrapolate our data and look at what the future holds, we expect that on the rate that our cases are decreasing, which on average of about 12 cases per day since January 22nd, I expect that we will be in the low-risk category by the middle of March. And then, of course, then vaccinations played a key in that, too. Once again, being the highest county in the state of Maryland with COVID-19 cases, I thought it was integral to make sure that our teachers were vaccinated before returning. And our county executive was instrumental in making sure that that happened. And so we expect that all of our educators will have their first vaccination and second vaccination by the end of March. Hence is how we arrived at April.
Speaking of teachers, I had a chance to speak with the president of the Prince George's County Educators Association. You know her well, Teresa Mitchell Dudley. And this is what she said in reaction to your announcement on Wednesday.
I am first and foremost grateful and thankful that that Dr. Golson has given us time for the employees of the school system to get vaccinated. The arbitrary and capricious date of March the 1st that the governor said that we should be returning was clearly not reflective of the availability of vaccines, first of all. Secondly, I do hope that Dr. Golson is very carefully looking at the open letter that we sent out, where we requested that we have continual negotiations about the working conditions for our members as we move back into the buildings. We want to make sure that all of the CDC guidelines and recommendations from the Department of Education are thoroughly reviewed and implemented in Prince George's County.
Of course, again, that was Teresa Mitchell Dudley, the president of the Prince George's County Educators Association. Your thoughts about what she did, what she said, particularly as it relates to the letter that was sent to you about a week or so ago and some of the concerns that she has had prior to having teachers go back.
Yeah, I'm grateful that we have an open line of communication, not just with our teachers union, but with all of our labor partners. And I do respond directly to our employees with their concerns. The same concerns she has are the same ones that we're addressing. And that's around, one, use of PPE, and then making sure that we have it available for not only staff but students, and making sure that our facilities are prepared and ready to receive both staff and students. And so while we have not been in our school buildings, with the exception of administrators who've been going and some central office staff, what we have been doing is preparing for this day, and that day means reopening. And so, you know, in all of our buildings, you'll find signage that talks about social distancing and wearing masks. We've changed all the air filters in our facilities to be MERV 13, which is consistent with CDC guidelines. We've done air quality assessments in all of our buildings. We have PPE that we've purchased. We've also received donations from Home Depot and just received an additional donation of 90,000 N95 masks from Prince George's County Homeland Security. We have hand sanitizer dispensers, liquids for the hand sanitizer machines. We're not allowing visitors in our buildings without appointments. We are having Wednesday breaks in between the Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday sessions to ensure that the facilities are thoroughly cleaned. We will have asymptomatic and symptomatic testing of both staff and students. We're going to adhere to the CDC guidelines around the 6 feet social distancing and requiring that everyone wears a mask all day long. Our custodians have been trained on cleaning and disinfecting training and received special equipment to do that. In order to get that equipment, they had to be trained. We've ordered bottled water. We have developed seating charts for buses, and we have purchased lots of cleaning supplies, including Clorox wipes, which are hard to find in a grocery store, but so that students can wipe down their area if they feel they need that extra layer of comfort and knowing that their space has been cleaned. So we've done a lot, and we plan to continue to do what's necessary to make our staff, our parents, and our students comfortable.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking to the CEO of the Prince George's County School System, Dr. Monica Golson, about the return to school plan that was announced earlier this week. If you have a comment, if you have a question for Dr. Golson, we invite you to join the conversation again at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. As always, we will be taking your phone calls even after 7:30 up until 8 o'clock this evening. My question as it relates to the teachers and parents, for that matter, this plan was developed prior to the announcement that you were going to reopen. If there are other concerns that arise between Wednesday when you announced and the 8th when all staff is scheduled to return, what kind of provisions have you made for additional discussions with the school, with the teachers union, or with parents?
Yeah. So one of the things we really want to continue to do is keep an open line of communication and transparency with our students and our staff. And so even after I made the announcement on Wednesday, I held a telephone town hall with our employees that had about 10,000 employees on the call. And then last night I held a community town hall, a telephone town hall that had about 25,000 community members on that call. We'll continue to do that so that we can answer people's questions. We've created frequently asked question documents. We have a reopening guide that's placed on our main webpage. And it's a great example of, we created that guide in August, but clearly things changed as we moved along this process. So, for example, when we started that guide and had it approved by Maryland State Department of Education, symptomatic and asymptomatic testing being available at the school level was not a conversation at that time. But it is now, and so we've updated that guide. So that's a good example of, it's a living document as we are moving and progressing through this and we find additional ways to provide safeguards to our families. We'll implement it and we'll include those in the guide so that our community can see it as well.
What is your biggest concern as you move through this process, even before you get the surveys completed by the 28th? Might you make some adjustments depending on what you hear from parents?
So what we hear from parents will help us to make sure that we have supported them in their decision-making process. But what I did say to parents last night is that ultimately the decision on whether to select hybrid or virtual learning falls on them. That has to be a home decision, one made with them and their child if necessary, and one that accommodates their own work schedule. And as we're listening to parents and they're giving feedback, one of the things that our parents have said to us is, hey, we need additional information around academic resources. And so I may choose to keep my time in virtual learning, but can you provide more resources? And so this week's weekly newsletter that we will send out to parents will be solely focused on just that, academic resources. So I do spend a lot of time listening to our parents because I think that's the only way that we have been able to navigate this whole year and to get through it is because we've done it together.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking to the CEO of the Prince George's County Public School System, Dr. Monica Golson, about returning to school, a plan she announced 2 days ago on Wednesday. Let's go to Ava, calling from Maryland. Ava, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to know, what strategy is being put in place to help the students keep from gathering together in crowds and maintaining the social distances to keep them from, you know, I know it's not a guarantee that they won't come in contact with COVID, but what kind of strategy you put in place to keep them from gathering together in crowds?
Yep. So the very first one that we're doing is the actual hybrid model schedule. And what that does is reduce our population by 50% completely. And that's if every family were to select coming back on a hybrid model. We already know from the responses that we've received thus far, even though we just released that survey, that not every parent plans to bring their child back on hybrid. So we already know we'll be at less than 50% capacity. The other thing is that schools will have to look at staggering dismissal between classes. So it doesn't mean that once that bell rings that everybody runs into the hallway. Each school is going to have to look at how many students are coming on Monday and Tuesday or Thursday, Friday, and navigating a bell schedule that allows fewer students in the hallway. There won't be lockers distributed. Cafeteria will look different. And as I reiterated on our community call with parents last night, this is a serious conversation to have with your child. This is not, to make the decision to come back for hybrid is not an opportunity to spend to congregate with your friends. It really is an instructional strategy that you're using to help to support your child academically. And so we will continue to reinforce the 6 feet social distancing and making sure that our students adhere to those guidelines. And when they don't, then they will have to be returned back to the virtual learning experience.
So you're suggesting that if the metrics reverse, or if you're not seeing widespread cooperation, that you may have to pull back on this?
Well, I'm saying individual students will have to go back. Yeah, individual. If a child refuses to wear a mask all day or does not comply with the guidelines set by the CDC that we'll be adhering to, then it's clear that that child has not made the necessary steps in order to ensure that they can remain in a hybrid model. And we will return that child back to virtual learning experience.
Okay. Ava, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking to the Prince George's County School System CEO, Dr. Monica Golson. She is answering your questions and ours. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. Download the app from Google Play or the Apple Store to hear the program live in its entirety. John Mons is next on WHUR with the original Quiet Storm. This conversation continues in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. I'm Harold Fisher. This is the Insight segment, and tonight we are talking to Prince George's County School CEO, Dr. Monica Golson, talking about going back to school, the process now underway, and that announcement coming just 2 days ago. If you have a comment or a question for her, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. What are the biggest concerns that you heard from parents on the call earlier this week?
Yeah, our parents' biggest concern is around facility safety. Children have been in their homes for almost a year, and so they know what to expect there. They're not sure what to expect in our schools. And so we will be issuing videos that show exactly what the inside of our schools look like. And every school will have a committee called a COVID compliance committee, and that's made up of the school nurse, building staff, meaning teachers, professional school counselors, custodians, who who every day are going to look and make sure that all of the guidelines that they've put in place in their school building are being adhered to. And the areas of improvement will be improved that night so that they can be in place the next day.
I want to go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Shawnee calling from Maryland. Shawnee, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm just curious as to why you wouldn't wait until the next school year to open. When the children return, they only have approximately 2 months of in-person learning. And going back to school, you know, it takes a lot of time to get acclimated. You have to go over, you know, the rules all over again. And, I mean, if you have the option to learn virtually, why not extend that until the end of the school year? And I'm just speaking as a teacher. When I go to work every day, because I was chosen to return to school for in-person learning, I am dressed as if I'm working in a lab, you know, like I'm dressed from head to toe because I am scared to get the virus. You know, teachers are going to school every day. I feel unnecessarily when we have the option of in-person learning. I don't believe that 2 months of in-person learning is going to make that much of a difference.
Thank you so much for your thoughts. While we've made some substantial investments to implement virtual learning for all of our students, what we do know is that there are some students whose attendance has declined after the second quarter and who are having difficult times continuing to adjust in the virtual learning experience. And knowing that and our metrics decreasing, we are providing an option for parents to make a choice whether their child is fits in that category and they believe that having that in-person experience is going to help them, at least for the last 48 instructional days of the school year, then we do want to provide that. While we've had some students who have said, this virtual learning experience has been the best thing for me and I want to continue it, on the other hand, we've had some who said, please allow me the opportunity to go back. I miss the direct interaction with my teacher, and I'm having a difficult time focusing on the screen.
Okay. Shawnee, thank you so much for your phone call, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Cassandra, also calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi.
Hi.
I was calling. I understand every school probably have a different position, but I was wondering what does fire drill look like? What does lockdowns look like? What would they look like knowing that the students need to huddle during lockdowns? And, you know, how does that look? Are we going to have, you know, things on the floor to let them know how far they need to go? Or just trying to see what that.
Yeah, excellent question. We are required by the fire department to have monthly fire drills. And the good thing about fire drills is that they take place outside. So our students will line up socially distanced, and they will be escorted outside, and they have to be a certain distance away from the school building for that actual fire drill. The teacher then has to take attendance while they're in that location. And then while custodial staff is doing the check of the building, along with the clearance from the fire department, after they've completed that process, they then give a signal for staff and students to return. In terms of a lockdown drill, our staff, luckily, will be at, once again, less than the 50% capacity. And then our staff will be trained on how to do a lockdown drill in the event that we have a situation to do that. But once again, students will still have to do that process with the 6 feet social distancing within the school building. But with fewer students, it'll be a lot easier to do.
Understand.
Thanks for that question.
Okay. Cassandra, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to the Prince George's County School CEO, Dr. Monica Golson, about the reopening of school. I want to talk to you a little more broadly about education and the impact on students and teachers beyond this logistical process. The state, and not just the state of Maryland, as you know, but educational associations across this country have spoken about what has often been considered a lost generation because of this pandemic. What do you hope or what do you fear is the outcome for the seniors that are going to graduate this year, this spring? What will their intellectual capacity look like, their educational capacity look like as they move out of the system and to life beyond high school?
Yeah, excellent. I appreciate the opportunity to share that, because I can tell you I've spoken to a lot of seniors who, interestingly, have doubled up on classes. I've talked to, at least within the last 3 months, seniors who have given up their lunch period because they're home and have picked up an additional course in order to prepare for their post-secondary experience. And what we do know is that in many of our universities, they too are learning under a hybrid model. They have some classes that are online and some that are in person. And so what I can tell you is that the seniors that leave any school district across the nation, they're all going to be able to adapt to a new way of teaching and learning. I've shared with all of our staff, I knew when I made that decision July 15th that we would not return until the end of the first semester, that how we taught and the school experience would be totally different from that day forward. And that's going to happen from henceforth. And so what we're used to experiencing as in the traditional model, our kids are not going to have that anymore. They are yearning for, I have kids who ask me all the time, can you please make sure we have a virtual school, because I don't want to come back in the fall, and I have thrived in this environment. And there's students who've learned a lot about what they're able to accomplish and not. I can tell you we've had an increase of over 1,000 students who participated in dual enrollment because of this pandemic. And what that has shown us is that an increase, what our previous barriers were around transportation. And so recently spoke to the new president of the Prince George's Community College to talk about how do we ensure that even when we return full schedule to the brick and mortar, that we can make sure that we sustain this increased interest in dual enrollment and we remove the barriers around transportation. So while I know people are extremely concerned about learning loss in this generation, I can tell you that many of our students have stepped up to the challenge and are going to excel. I can also tell you that what this has shown us is that we have to do a lot around socio-emotional support. We've done a lot around academics, but this pandemic has shown that we have to take care of the whole child. This has allowed us to begin to have those conversations and to start to implement strategies to do that.
Well, I think is probably my next point, because while, yes, many of them have stepped up to the plate to accept the challenge of that the pandemic has brought to them. But there are so many others, and Dr. Golson, I'm sure you're well aware of this, that have fallen by the wayside. They were struggling before the pandemic and are struggling even more so. How do you retain those students who were struggling with so many issues regarding just learning?
Yeah, there's so many factors that go into a student becoming disengaged. And we've done our best to try to remove some of those barriers. One, food, which is why we make sure that all of our students had a meal. Have meals Monday through Friday. They pick them up on Monday, Wednesday. When we became one-to-one, we realized that there were some homes that didn't have internet. And so we, with Board of Education approval, realigned money so that we could make sure that every kid was online. And at the same time, we also acknowledge that there are some families where the adults, the parents in that home lost their jobs, and now children are having to help in maintaining their home by working and also doing the learning portion from their classes. So we're finding ways with the help of our community partners to keep students engaged. Yes, there have been some students who have started out really well at the beginning of the school year, and it has started to fade on them signing in all of their classes. They may start in the morning, and by the afternoon, they're done with screen time. But I can tell you we have some nonprofit organizations who are assisting with literally going to homes and knocking on the door to say, hey, we notice your child is not online. What can we do to get them refocused? It's also why we have to reopen our schools, and it's safe to do that in April, which allows another form of a safety net to support those students who are at a loss for this new way of learning.
What about summer school?
Yeah, so we definitely will have a summer school experience. Last summer, we offered free summer school to all students. We did lessons on our public television station for elementary students, and then we did online support for middle and high school students. We had 1,000 students at the secondary level who took courses for the first time instead of just recovery courses. We plan to do the same this summer, and if our COVID-19 cases continue to remain at a low rate, we expect to have a hybrid experience for summer school as well. The other thing that we learned from this last summer that we will institute for this year's summer is that every student will have a coach at the secondary level, because even if you're doing the online learning experience, because the content is accelerated, you do need someone who's going to come on and check on you, make sure that you're keeping up, assist you in answering questions, and provide that additional one-on-one tutoring if you need it in order to be successful.
Where will those coaches come from?
We're going to continue to offer that again this summer, and it will be for free.
Where will those coaches come from? Who will they be?
So we're grateful that we've received CARES Act funding from the federal government and expect to receive additional funding from our new administration that will assist us in helping to fund summer school.
I want to ask you about, and you mentioned CARES Act, and I think that's a really good point. One of the biggest concerns that teachers have, of course, is not so much the PPE. That is a concern, but probably the most expensive thing is the repairing of HVAC systems. That has always been an extremely expensive proposition.
Yes, and
and the Prince George's County school system, even when I was in high school, and at Eleanor Roosevelt, but paying attention to the news and things like that. Yeah, I did that even back then. Mm-hmm. That was, those infrastructure issues were always expensive, problematic, points of contention. So now that there are concerns that have to do with overall health in the HVAC system, and as you know, there are systems within the school system that are HVAC systems that need to be repaired. How are you going to pay for that?
Really, everyone, including you, Harold, know that our buildings have an average age of 50 years of age. And in some cases, the life cycle of our HVAC systems have been replaced only twice in that 50-year time span. What we have done is prioritize and make sure that at least all of our HVAC systems are working and functioning. Does every building have a new HVAC system? Definitely not, which is why adherence to the CDC guidelines around having MERV 13 filters is so important. But we also received some information today that I shared with our chief financial officers that there may be some additional support and relief through FEMA. And so we're hoping to receive that information in the coming weeks that may allow us to accelerate some of our other additional HVAC system repairs that we would not have been able to financially cover if we weren't in this pandemic. Just to put a context around the replacement of an HVAC system, it ranges in the low cost of $20 million in a large high school. An Eleanor Roosevelt HVAC system would have been even more complex and more than that. So if you can just think of size and cost, it would be almost impossible to replace it in all 206 of our schools. But we are making sure that it functions in every building.
Where are you with that? Do you have an idea of how many schools can be immediately addressed?
So right now, all our schools have HVAC and heating system. Right now, we're in the heating portion of it, though, that are functioning. We do have 6 schools at this point where they might have a few rooms that we're working on to make sure that the heating system is back up. But the full entire building, we have no buildings where it's completely out. And so we'll continue to monitor and ensure that our facilities have circulating air. That is one of the recommendations from CDC and even our external medical advisory team experts around the advantage of returning in the spring, because where possible, the cheapest thing to do that is safe is to open windows for air. And that is listed on the CDC guidelines. And while we appreciate having that, we do still acknowledge that we have students who have allergies. So the ideal is to have our HVAC systems working.
I want to ask you about another issue outside of this that has certainly creeped up. And certainly you are part of the executive branch of the school system. But the legislative branch, the school board, has had some issues that have crept up. The, you know, Dr. Miller, who is the school board chair, has brought about some concerns about unethical or potentially illegal activities on the board. Your thoughts about what is happening with that and what impact that could possibly have on decisions that you are making going forward?
I can share with our community, one, I spoke to every board member individually around our reopening plan for April, and all of them asked questions, made sure that we had every provision in place for staff, students, and even supporting both staff and students' families when we return. I did that same process in July, right before we made the announcement, July 15th, did the same thing when we made a decision December 1 to continue under virtual learning, and did that same process on this one. And so what I can tell you is, while there may be discussions that they're working through between board work, I can tell you that our work as a collective body has not slowed down. They've been extremely supportive around the decision-making I've made, and have allowed me over the past several months to really focus on how we get students back in, do it safely, and find ways to recover and learning loss. And so I have been, as you can see from the extreme details of our reopening, I have been immersed in it. I've lost sleep every night, not over board concerns, but over children and staff concerns. And they've allowed me the opportunity to do that and to keep me out of what's happening with them. And so I'm grateful for that. We continue to work cohesively and together as a whole team, and we'll continue to do that for our staff and students.
Are you at all
confident that they will resolve any issues that they have?
Well, are you at all concerned that the movement and the call for, you know, an audit, particularly around contracts, could in any way, shape, or form affect how you operate going forward? I mean, suffice it to say, I don't have to say this.
Definitely not. I can tell you, for a $2.6 billion corporation, that's what we are. We have audits all the time. That's not necessarily because they're improprieties, but because we want to make sure that we have the right efficiencies and policies and procedures in place to ensure that we are using the taxpayer dollars effectively. And so an audit does not stop my ability to function and ensure that PPE is in our buildings, air purifiers in our temporaries that aren't bringing in fresh air, plexiglass is in our point of sales in the cafeteria, buses are ready to roll with gas in them, and staff is comfortable returning in the schoolhouse in the middle of March. None of that will hamper our ability to continue to move forward.
I want to talk a little bit, okay, and I want to talk a little bit about money as well, because the country is currently in an economic crunch, but could very well see, you know, similar things. Are you against or in favor of corporations adopting and naming schools like stadiums are named, like FedEx Field? Big money to get FedEx name on the field. Are you against a Nike High School or a Converse Elementary or or Apple Field?
You know, I think what I can say is that our communities have taken great pride in the naming of our school buildings, and I would hate for us to take that away just so that we could get corporate funding to support schools. There are ways to still support education, and it's through educational foundations. Most large urban school districts have a foundation where businesses and organizations, corporate, can contribute. We have ours. Ours is called Excellence in Education Foundation. And because of our public-private partnership that we just approved, we just received $1 million endowment to put in that foundation to help to support students and scholarships. There doesn't have to be a name on that. At the end of the day, that $1 million will get dispersed amongst our students over the next 20, 30 years around support, scholarships, and educational programs in our building. So it doesn't necessarily have to have that name. And what I'd hate to do is take away the opportunity for a community to name a school that brings them great pride, like a Barack Obama or a Dr. Henry A. Wise Junior High School or a G. James Goldson Middle School. They're all from pillars that are ideal people that we look up to and that our community enjoyed naming their buildings after.
But is it possible to do both? Is it possible to have, you know, a Barack Obama Elementary School and a Samsung Field?
Well, actually, we have, in many cases, if you go out into some of our football fields now, you'll see where we've had sponsors who have made a large contribution so that their name could be displayed on the field. Dr. Henry A. Wise, a school that's home to state champions for multiple years. There are lots of organizations that love to pay and have their name displayed there. It doesn't mean that they necessarily own the building. It just means that they can have their name displayed in that stadium. It doesn't take away from it. I don't think that's a problem at all. What I would want to make sure is that our community has the opportunity to name schools after people or under, you know, that provides a historic perspective.
How would you define at the end of this school year, the spring school year, how would you define a new normal for parents, teachers, and students?
You know, a new normal will be not what it was before. A new normal will be for some students reporting to school every day, maybe under a flexible schedule that allows them to have in-person learning maybe in the morning and virtual in the afternoon. A new normal for another family could be virtual learning Monday through Friday and them leaving their home at the end of that virtual learning experience and then participating in after-school activities in person. A new normal could be mental health supports and families coming directly to school to receive counseling on individualized and then family unit support that helps them to move forward. A new normal could be serving meals in the evening while staff actually trains parents on work-based learning. And a new normal could be parent, teacher, student association meetings done virtually with hundreds of people attending from home and not coming back into the brick and mortar.
I asked you this the last time you were on the program, and I remember what you said, not a trick question, but what have you learned now? It's been a year since this pandemic began for all of us. As a manager of one of the largest school systems in the country, what have you learned?
I have learned that together as a community, we are a lot more powerful than we think we are. We have served over 1 million meals since this started. Our parents have become co-teachers. There's a mutual respect amongst parents and teachers about what we all have done to support our students. We realize that our social-emotional being, well-being, is just as important as the academics. And we've learned to trust each other in decision-making.
You, and this is part and parcel of that, and I didn't ask you the last time, but I believe I said something about nobody was ready for this. The world has never seen really anything like this, even in 1918. But, you know, for you personally, what have you learned about yourself as a person and as a manager, as a CEO of the school system?
Yeah, I have learned personally that it takes this entire village. And I have learned to figure out a work-life balance that I kind of took for granted before. I could work from 6 in the morning until 10 at night. But this pandemic has caused me as a manager to take some time for myself to step back so that I could be the whole person I needed to be in order to make the right decisions for our staff and community. And it has allowed me to continue to rely on my faith to get us through each and every day.
I think I can stop there and let you at least try to enjoy a piece of the weekend as it gets underway, whatever that will look like. I think we all need a breather after this week.
I agree.
Dr. Monica Golson, CEO of the Prince George's County School System, thank you so very much. Good luck to you. I'm sure we'll be talking again because, again, this process is just beginning. Lots of work ahead, as you know. I don't have to tell you that.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. That is the Daily Drum for this Friday, February 19th. For News Director Renee Nash, reporters Bramante Bryant, Millette Green, producer Candace Atkins, and engineer Bobby Adams, I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for Unheard with Wes Hall. Have a good weekend. Good night.